And welcome to Here We Stand. Let that word ring out all over the world, all over Kanata. Let that word bring down all the tyranny, all the fear. People, this is your regular host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice, here with you today. And it's October 11th. We are here to let freedom reign, first in our hearts, then in our communities, and then all over the world. We have the numbers. We have the clarity of mind, the purity of heart, and the strength of will to make it happen, brothers and sisters. That's why we're here every week. That's why we at work every day to reclaim our people under a new jurisdiction, the Republic of Kanata, formerly the territory of the Dominion of Canada. That's another word we got to dispense with. Dominion means domination. No more domination, people. I am here today to talk about how we are conducting the battle now, the lessons of the last little while. I have a brilliant co-host with me, Deb Golding, former Mormon, freedom fighter down in the States. Welcome, Deb.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm excited to be on again. Enjoy
it. It's always good to be with you. And, you know, one of the quotes I was going to share right at the beginning, which I'm going to do now, is, "We will bring to light the hidden works of darkness and drive falsity to the bottomless pit." And that was written by my ancestor, Peter Annett, in 1761. He was a free thinker and real shit disturber back in England. And he wrote that just before he was thrown in the stocks in Charing Cross in London for writing seditious pamphlets that criticized the Church of England. Well, things come around, right? And we're doing the same battle now, you know, Deb, bringing to light the hidden works of darkness, driving lies to the bottomless pit. But when we do that, we expect and always receive a counterattack. And I want to talk about that a little bit today. And for folks listening in, don't forget you can follow all of our work, Republic of Kanata, that's K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.ca, and murderbydecree.com. And for you folks on the West Coast who are considering marking a ballot in the next few weeks for the British Columbia elections, don't. Because just a few months ago, politicians passed Bill 19, which said they're above the law. You cannot sue a politician anymore, any more than you can sue Big Pharma for any wrongdoing. So why would you mark a ballot and ratify your own slavery? We're saying don't vote for this system. We're setting up Republic of Kanata alternate balloting systems where you can vote for the Republic, join a local Republic Assembly, take back power. So keep that in mind when you're seeing all this propaganda about, you know, there's this nonsense on the buses in Vancouver. It shows people all dutifully wearing masks holding ballots, if you can believe it, right? Yeah, we're all good slaves. We want to mark X and confirm that we want to be ruled, right? So anyway, that's a little reminder of what we're up against. Deb, welcome. And any thoughts on the latest madness or anything you want, you know, while we jump into this whole topic?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many thoughts. Gosh, honestly, I think it's really important. I know where we're going to go with some of the comments and the discussion we're going to have today, but it's so powerful to me that you're mentioning, you know, just what you did. When to create something new instead of actually asking the system, the broken system that is currently in place to create the newness is that's actually asking something that has no capacity to hold or to even create from to make it, you know. So it's right. I don't know. Maybe I was just thinking about this. It's like we want to fly a plane, but we keep putting effort into fixing the wagon wheel, you know. So doing something that really is groundbreaking, is something of newness. Is exactly what I see, you know, you doing and the people that are gathering, putting energy into. There was a quote by Bucky Fuller saying, "You never change something by fighting the existing reality. To change something, you build a new model that makes the existing model look obsolete." And so what right. that requires is people being willing to take a risk, be uncomfortable, work with the change, and in what you just said, don't mark the ballot, don't ratify what was already there. And so, and then you brought in your ancestor and the quote that he said. So that the first question I actually would love to ask you is, where did this come from? Where did this begin? Like, can you speak to that? You've had so many years of experience, and some people just don't really know really clearly your story or where you've gotten your momentum. And so would you speak to that for a moment?
Well, the disease is pretty old in our culture, you know, Deb. And anybody who does any reading history, you know, not the kind of crap we're fed in school or even a lot on the internet, but just, you know, from our own understanding and a kind of maybe our genetic memory, what we know intuitively. Because we carry the atoms and the energy of ancestors going back hundreds of generations. So that truth, you know, that's kind of the basic idea of common law. The truth is within us. You know, the kingdom of heaven is within us. And we just have to look inside, and the answers are often there. But this immediate global genocide going on is nothing new, and we all know that. I just gave a talk the other night to some people where we went into this for several hours about how the fact that a system is able to wipe out whole groups of people legally, and then the people who were part of that culture that made it happen, who paid for it, as we did in Canada and in America and elsewhere, paid for it with our taxes, paid with it in the collection plates on Sunday. Now we're wondering why it's blowing back on us, why mandatory vaccinations, which have been the law in Canada for Indians since 1874, you know, why is it now happening to us? So it's not a matter of saying, well, if only we could go back to the way it was a year ago. Well, folks, a year ago, it was just as bad. It just wasn't affecting us. And so it's inherent in the culture, what we call Christendom. You know, I've talked a lot about this on previous shows and murderbydecree.com. We can get into that. What really intrigues me, Deb, is how it's like, you know, we're obviously dealing with a system of mass psychosis, because no group of people can do a crime for so long without really it driving them crazy. And the characteristics of group psychosis, take something like as simple as the mask. You know, I was in the store today, and of course I was the only one there who wasn't muzzled, and everyone was afraid of me. But I realized that, you know, someone wearing that mask around all the time, it's like what the Star of David armband was in the ghettos of Europe, you know, during the Nazi era. People wore the Star of David armband when you were a Jew because they believed that that gave them protection. Okay, some Nazi thugs are going to beat me up because I'm dutifully wearing the armband. What it meant, of course, in the long run, is you're going to be shipped in a cattle car somewhere and you're going to die. But people can't see that long-term reality. They can only see the short-term protective thing. So people literally believe that they wear these things and it's going to keep them safe. It's really a mask of a badge of membership in the corporatocracy. It's saying, yes, exactly, we're part of this corporate machine that's now consuming the whole planet. It's like sucking out all the energy of the planet and us into this one big machine. But it's been around for many centuries, as I think, you know, a lot of us know now.
Well, it's definitely playing into the corporation, the corporatocracy, the mindset of corporate belonging or corporate branding is the word I'm looking for. So,
right,
are you branded as part of that society? And what it's doing is definitely separating and isolating, when in reality, we're stronger as we come together and we see more similarities with each other. It was funny, I was thinking, I think we're about, maybe 2 weeks into the masking, the declaration of wear masks, you know, it's back in March or early April. And I wonder how long before this becomes stylized, you know, as a statement. I mean, how long before it takes companies to look at that and go, wow, here's a way to make a buck, right? And here it is. You know, you can purchase all kinds of different, you know, masks, but the masking, regardless of what's on it, what's branded, how blingy it is, or if it's just a paper thing, the point is you're still masking, and that branding, that corporate branding of I belong or I believe in this fear or the CDC or whatever. Yeah. They've got the coin of the, you know, anti-maskers. At least that's something that is said out here. You know, there's, that person's an anti-masker. Sounds like the anti-vaxxers, you know. It's just this labeling that is so derogatory on both sides of the scale.
Well,
when really coming together is, that's another hurdle right there. It's just plainly right there, another hurdle of people coming together and saying, we don't want this corporate we don't want this corporate mass mind, we want to have culture, we want to have community, and this steps in the way of it.
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting. You talked about where it all comes from and examples from the past. This is, and we're going to get into this a little bit because we want to talk about the pushback that's happened from the state, the way they've infiltrated and disrupted. 8 of the 10 assemblies we've set up on the west coast of Canada have now been taken down or destroyed from within by a planned action by the state to do that, send in infiltrators, rumor mongers, all that kind of thing. But it's a replay of exactly what happened to our movement 20 years ago, 15 years ago in Canada to expose the residential school genocide. And what's really amazing about this is that genocide is always cast in terms of a public health measure. In Nazi Germany, they described needing to clean the vermin out of society, calling Slavs, Jews, anybody who wasn't in the kind of Aryan system as literally a rodent or a bug that had to be removed. The early sterilization laws in America and Canada, the ones that the Nazis copied, they didn't invent them. They borrowed them from America, the sterilization laws in the late 19th century against, you know, all sorts of groups. It was described as, well, we have to sterilize these people for public health measures. And similarly, the whole COVID thing, because the elites that run the society know, well, who pretend to run the society, know that if you describe things as a public health measure, nobody can really mentally resist that because do you want to get sick and die? Do you want to stand by and let your neighbor make you infected? It's a brilliant method to turn people against each other and get everybody on board with a fascist system. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, to keep in mind that it's a replay of something that has worked before. And we know what their plan is from how they've exposed themselves with this.
So tell us, I guess, what you've noticed. I mean, you've had practice with this then 15 years ago, but then over the last 6 months, what exactly have you noticed? Like, obviously there's isolation going on when a group comes together, but you talk about being infiltrated, they're sending somebody. What has been your experience? What happened with this? I think you've referred to it as controlled dissent. Really get into that. Describe that.
Well, it's a really important topic. Controlled opposition or controlled dissent. It's the first response of the state to a real threat to itself. They don't send in the cops. Like in meetings, people are always saying, what do I do if the cops come to the door? The cops will not come to the door. They don't have to. There's 3 or 4 steps they do before that where they get people to shut themselves down and to self-sabotage. And it's a very simple process when you're in a climate of fear and people are relatively ignorant. You know, they're new to politics. Many of the people getting involved in our common law assemblies, they come in again, will get up and say, I wasn't involved or aware or interested in politics until 6 months ago and this COVID thing struck. So they're novices and they don't know what they're dealing with. They kind of, you know, violate the first principle of when Sun Tzu talks about in the Art of War, know your enemy and know yourself. Because if you don't know your enemy, you're ruined from the very beginning. And what controlled dissent and controlled opposition is, first level of response, the state captures your rhetoric, captures and turns it in the direction they want. So, for example, they don't come in and repress people. That creates more opposition and more support. We want to be attacked because that swells our ranks. What they do is they come in and take your language and turn it in another direction so they can control it. For example, we started a truth commission into genocide in Canada in Vancouver right after our first tribunal in the summer of 1998. We set up the truth commission into genocide in Canada. Canada responds, or the Canadian government responds, by eventually setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We had a website for a long time called Hidden No Longer. And the government native chief set up an organization response called Idle No More. You see, they take the title and then they spin it. And Idle No More wasn't talking about genocide. They were diverting all of the upset over the genocide onto the issue of treaty rights, which is an issue that only helps the government chiefs, right? So you see, they've done the same thing now. To give you a recent example of this, when we started a whole Common Law Republic campaign 5 years ago, and then most recently in March in response to the COVID thing, where we activated all these common law assemblies across the country, several groups appeared right away and began using the same rhetoric. They all started talking common law, but here's what they said. We want to teach people about common law. We want to hold rallies, and we don't want to have a republic, and we don't want to associate with Kevin Annett. These groups unify the people. You know, the anti-masking groups in Toronto, of various people online. You can see who they are. And, you know, they identify themselves by the way they talk. So what that does is it says, okay, we'll take the issue, which is a threat to the system. That is the idea of a new republic that's cutting off all ties with the crown. But if we spin it, so we say, well, we want to protest instead. Well, protest achieves nothing. It gets people together. It does two things for the state. It identifies who the activists are. Hi, here we all are. We're all standing together publicly. And it also it's a dead end. It doesn't build any alternative, you know, and so that's an example of what controlled dissent or opposition does, right? Go ahead, sir.
Oh, no, that's okay. I'm listening to what you have saying. So once they bring in the dissent, then what I'm hearing is they create or I guess target, take advantage of, target people's own fears of what if this, what if that. So I guess what I'm recognizing and maybe what I would love to have addressed by you or what I'd like to pass on is the fact that when you're starting something new, this is going to be uncomfortable and there's going to be some painful experiences in this because the whole process of creating something new is going to go through its own growing pains. I mean, as I've been looking at it from my point of view, I have children, but I can compare this actually to childbirth. I mean, this has got it. When you're in childbirth, you have one outcome, and that is, you know, you've got a baby being born. But the process of having that happen is uncomfortable, is unknown. There's parts that create, you know, some fears, but there's some real strength that comes with the privilege of that experience too. But it gets painful, and so what I think gets preyed upon that I'm hearing you say is our own or the people's own desire to be out of uncomfortability or out of pain is actually appealed to. Oh, you mean you don't want to, you know, like right. feel that? Well, come on over here and we're just going to gather and rally and everybody can feel good. Yeah. We're going to appeal to that, which takes you away from the end game of actually creating something new, which is
exactly.
definitely a painful, uncomfortable process. And I think that's where the sifting really does come through, where you can look at the situation, you can look at your own uncomfortability and say, I am mature enough or I am okay enough with myself and with what I want the outcome to be to sit in this uncomfortability and feel this pain and know that I'm still in the space where I'm not afraid of that, or even if I am afraid of it, I'm gonna sit with this. I'm gonna champion myself instead of really just kind of, I mean, honestly, there are so many conditioning situations that support people, especially that I know of, getting out of pain. Man, if you're in pain, grab some ibuprofen, grab some, you know, acetaminophen, yeah. whatever. But like, medicate yourself out of it. And if you can't, then, you know, like deny it or bury it or whatever. And going through processes that really do accentuate this pain, I think you're pretty familiar with. I mean, I know as you know, in your experience when you were in your ministry, you know, and you did conduct funerals, you helped people die, you helped families go through death processes, and told me a lot of times that process is very intimate, but you've experienced different reactions to that.
Yeah, well, that's a good analogy because we're going through a death, you know, and it's we always think in terms of salvaging a situation rather than accepting that something could be over, whether it's a relationship, a life, a society, right? And so people always want to hear a good word, a good message, and a good infiltrator, an operative, will prey on that immediately. And I want to give you a very specific example. We had a Vancouver Common Law Assembly until last week. At one point, there was up to 24 people coming regularly, and these were very committed people. They were buying our books on the Republic, on the Common Law Assembly. 12 of them had just stood up, and they were so excited about joining the Republic, they'd taken the vow together. They had taken the pledge and said it in unison. Okay. 5 days later, they all resigned. Now, what caused that? There was a guy named Andre. He was a South African. Now, that's interesting because we've found over the years that the RCMP and South African expatriates are working in Canada, and they're often tied into covert actions, drug operations, this whole bit. South African secret police have had long ties with the RCMP and their activities in Canada. So it's interesting he was South African. But this fellow showed up, and he began, when I wasn't there, and it always happens when I'm not there, the takedown in Parksville happened the same way. They wait till I'm not at a meeting, and then they say two things. They say, you know, people who associate with Kevin Anna die, and you can bring a lot of heat on yourself if you associate with him. So don't you think it's safer if we just separate from him and from the Republic and just work on our local assembly? And they all went along with it. Now, his words couldn't have had an impact unless people were already afraid and didn't know enough about me or the situation to see, okay, this is a typical divide-and-conquer tactic. We're not going to fall for this. But people in their naivety went along with it. But here's the advantage. Here's the way that we can, like Sun Tzu says, you turn an attack that comes at you, you turn around and use it to your advantage. One of his points in The Art of War, Sun Tzu says, when attacked by a larger aggressor, engage the aggression by guiding it into conditions favorable to you. So this is what we did. We said to the people who remained, there was like five people left over after the rest resigned, we said, don't you see how this disruptor has helped us? He showed us who the weak ones in the group were. And he made you guys even more firm in your belief, because the ones who remained said, okay, this was an obvious takedown. We learned something from this, and we're going to be more aware next time. So what our apparent adversary has done is actually helped us. He's sifted out the wheat from the chaff, that people are going to fall away easily from the ones who will remain behind. That's how we can use any situation to our advantage. We got to think like Sun Tzu says, right? You operate like a water around a rock. There is no final outcome of any battle or any war. You have to continually use the attacks in you to your advantage by outthinking your adversary. So this is what we've done. In fact, now the Vancouver group is even more solid. They're planning actions. They're going to be going all on Commercial Drive and on the east side of Vancouver and doing unmasking actions this coming week, telling people not to vote. They've really been energized by what happened. So we turned it to our advantage. And this is why you can't get discouraged when these attacks happen, how we can actually use them.
Wow. You know what? That is actually excellent information because, again, if once something gets attacked or targeted, it would be pretty discouraging. I mean, honestly, to be demoralized by what you think is going forward. And so using that example and just say, hey, you know what? This really did strengthen those of us that are here. We can really even add in an anchor of trust here based on the fact that we all can really rely on the fact that we're coming from the same place. You know, these are people who are willing to, you know, have a vision for a different societal model and put themselves into the struggle to really plant ways of having that model grow and supporting that. I think that speaks to them. I'm really glad that you brought that up. Absolutely. I'm curious what other challenges have come. I mean, I have two questions. What other challenges have come up recently that you've noticed that speaks to this? And the other thing is why, with all of the experience perhaps that you have to bring to the table, would people listen to somebody that just showed up and said, you know, something else that appeals to their fears? Why would they kind of, you know, disregard all of the years of experience that you've got or that anybody else would actually have in favor of something else that was just kind of just popped into the mix?
I think there's there's obvious issues of fear and everything, but there's a deeper reason, and that's because human beings are both attracted and repelled by purity, whether it's love, truth, integrity, and a human being. We love it, and yet we feel lessened by it because, oh, I can't measure up to that, or this might threaten my life, you know? And, you know, so that I've experienced this a lot, you know, just the more I've done this work, that people, one minute I experienced it really powerfully in the Native groups, many of the Native groups I've worked in the Aboriginal residential school healing circles. Native people would be adoring me and standing by me one moment and then fiercely attacking me the next because I was supposed to be their savior. I was the white guy that was supposed to deliver them. And when I didn't deliver, they got angry at me. It's like the way a child thinks. You know, you rely on a parental figure for everything, and you can't stand on your own feet and think for yourself and take responsibility yourself. And many of us are in that childlike state where we've never learned to have sovereignty in our own minds, to think for ourselves. And anyone who embodies that is a threat. And so it's easy to turn on those people and rip them apart. And, you know, it's kind of like people, I remember it was kind of embarrassing. A woman once got up in a meeting and was just lauding me. She said, "Oh, Kevin, you're so Christ-like." And I say, "Does that mean you're going to get out the nails?" Right? Because the purpose of a Christ-like figure is to be offered up as a sacrifice for people at the same time. That's in our Christian paradigm mindset, right? You love, you know, the warrior, hero, savior, but then you crucify him the next moment when you have to, you know, need a convenient scapegoat. So we got to get away from the whole thinking and get people to see that savior is within yourself. And once you take responsibility, right?
You know what? That is actually the key. But I think what we're also doing, I mean, here's where, in my mind, it's so valuable, the self-introspection and the self-knowing, or the self-learning. I guess I'm going to say self-discovery is so much a part of all of this because, you know, we do want to fight that. But what we're fighting is again, that unfamiliarity and that uncomfortability within ourselves. And so that can show up as anger. It can show up as rage. It can show up as withdrawing. Yeah. It can show up as a number of different emotions that we wouldn't necessarily trace back to what you just talked about unless we took the time to trace it back to that. I mean, the fact that we have this fascination, this attraction and fascination and a repulsion also with the integrity of all of it. You know, we want to engage. We want to engage, and yet we want to push away from it because right. There's so much about it that we can see in ourselves. It's like looking into your own shadow space, your own, you know, your own abyss, really. It's like you look in there long enough and you're going to see it staring back at you, which really is an invitation if you choose to see it that way.
Well, isn't that true, Deb, about love and personal relationships? And that's why so many relationships fall apart these days, because ultimately, do people really want to take responsibility for their own feelings? Because when you love someone, you're ultimately vulnerable. And that's in an age of fear and paranoia, mass fear and paranoia like ours, that's something that's difficult. So I think there's a lot of lessons for our own life we can apply to these bigger struggles we're in. One of the things I want to mention, too, is, you know, I always love to take one or two quotes from Sun Tzu and use them in a show. And one that's really relevant, there's two of them here. Always carefully discern your enemy's purpose. The knowledge of that purpose comes only from active contact with your opponent. Provoke them to reveal themselves. Assess their nature and responses. Prick them and know their movements. Probe them and learn their strengths and deficiencies. And following on that, never reinforce error or defeat. Now, that's a big one, because when you make a mistake, you don't repeat it again. And this is what I don't get. When we expose these people who've done these infiltration and disruptions, right? And then the same people who did the disruptions or working with others turn around and are invited to speak in other groups who are working with us, even though they know these people have just taken down one of our groups, because they don't learn from their own experience. You see, they can't accept that people are doing bad things. We want to think only the good about people all the time. That way we don't have to deal with the ugliness in the world, and we can live in our little cocoon. Amazing inability to learn from an experience, and we keep repeating the same errors over and over.
I think it takes a lot of courage, actually, because we do want to we do want to give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, we don't want to think bad of someone. I mean, and this speaks so clearly to you talked about relationship earlier. We can see it in close proximity by if we took the moment to look at some of the closest relationships that really just kind of, you know, poke at us or really just, you know, trigger us and light us up in negative ways. It's like, well, what about that is so electrifying, because you will stay in these relationships and I'm talking about even relationship with the government, relationship with community, relationship all over the place. We stay in these relationships because in order to actually take a stand and say, you know what, my integrity, my sense of what is right in my heart, in my gut, tells me something different. But then you look at that and go, but gosh, is that person really that bad? And so we just give all of these allowances for the toxicity, if, you know, since that's there, to maintain itself. And it takes a real step in the direction of personal courage to actually stand next to yourself, you know, kind of support yourself and say, actually, no, that toxicity is not allowed in my space anymore. I am going to stand next to myself and say no to this. But it's, you know, it does take some courage, because if that person that's toxic is, say, a parent, and you can say, I don't care what your title is, this toxicity is not allowed in my life anymore, what you're doing is you're going up against a lot of societal situations that people feel very uncomfortable with, and people take a lot of entitlement with, too. And I have personal experience with that. I cut off all relationship with my parents, I think it's been 17 years now, when I realized that they were my perpetrators. They were the ones delivering me to all of the things that I would, you know, my own torture, my own ritual abuse. It was in the family. It was also in the church, and I was being taken to those places by my dad. It doesn't matter. It does not matter what the title is, father, mother, grandparent, aunt, uncle, whatever, the toxicity and what was going on, the attacks that was there. I looked at that and I was like, that's not in my life. No, I don't care what your title is. You have no entitlement to this anymore. And really, that pushes against society's idea of what should be and what's appropriate. And, oh, let's give them a little bit more. And I tell people, it's like, you know, if all of those same actions were being done to me, but by a neighbor, would you fault me for saying, you as a neighbor are no longer allowed in my life? And they say, well, of course not. And I'm like, how is that different than it being my own father? How is that different than my family? It's not different.
It isn't. That's an amazing example, Deb, from your own. Now, again, here's an example. You learn from a life experience. If you had ignored that and kept going dutifully back to your father all the time, continue to get tortured, you're not, you know, you've surrendered your ability to make your own judgments and go your own way. And I look around in society, and that's where most people are at, including the ones who consider themselves, you know, awake. People may express ideas that they're awake, but their behavior patterns are exactly those of a slave. And that, you know, and so it's more than just, you know, talk. It's proven out in practice. And I wanted to run down a checklist. This is a checklist for people who are listening, because anyone who's involved in the common law assembly connected to our republic is going to be targeted. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. And here's the things to look out for. There's six characteristics of, I'll call them a decoy. These are people sent in, or let's just, you know, I don't believe in naming names of prominent people on the internet, because then it gets into a name-calling tit-for-tat. I know these people who I'm not going to mention make a profession out of attacking me all the time, but I'm not going to do that in response. But they talk, I think we'll know who, you know, when I mention what they do, we'll know who we're talking about. They're decoys. They're set up publicly to talk about the issues we're talking about, but send it in a different direction, in opposition to what we're building, which is people taking back power in their own communities. I'll call them the decoy. First of all, first characteristic of the decoy, they suddenly appear on the internet out of the blue. You've never heard about them before. They don't have any life, proven life experience, no background. People know with me that 25 years ago, I was fired as a United Church minister, never used a pseudonym. You can track my history of what I've done and gone through, but you can't track these people. They're just appearing out of nowhere. And yet, people are believing them because they're saying everything they want to hear. You know, they're saying, oh, here's the details of the common law. Here's how you can navigate the court system. So they keep holding up these experts on common law. And that's the first characteristic. They just appear out of nowhere. Secondly, they just talk. They're not ever saying, okay, let's do something. Let's organize our own assembly. Let's pass our own laws, as we've done in the Republic, saying these COVID measures are illegal. They don't do any of that. It's always at the level of talk. Thirdly, they're connected to groups that simply protest. The extent of their action is a protest. They never go beyond that. And that's because they're working at the behest, either whether they're aware of it or not, they're working at the behest of the state, which needs dissent controlled and corralled into an observable protest. They don't want people taking back money, not paying taxes, not voting. They want them corralled into a predictable thing. And again, that's violating Art of War, who says never do anything predictable around a bigger adversary because then you're going to get wiped out. No, we don't protest. That's what they're expecting, right? That's the third thing. They constrict and control the opposition. Fourthly, they attack the people who are a real threat. Okay, people like me and others who have this knowledge, who are revolutionaries in the sense we're saying we need to overturn this system and bring in something different. They oppose the revolutionary, the threat to the system. They attack them personally. They disparage them. They put in an enormous smear campaign. I estimate the RCMP has spent tens of millions of dollars in the black ops operation against me started in the summer of 1998. They have to get people afraid of the revolutionaries in their midst. Fifth point, they always use very pretentious words and image, like that example of the native group that set itself up, the government native group, Idle No More. I mean, how many natives do you know in the street who use that kind of language, right? Or people call themselves common law warriors, a warrior calls, the warrior. You know, it's always these pretentious terms, and that's to cover up the fact that these people are creations. They've been artificially created and put out there. And so you get people don't look past the pretentious image as to who these people really are. And finally, they act very rapidly. They've got to take down the real threat, the revolutionaries, if you like, in this case, our republic. They've got to take them down quick because they're on a payroll and they need to produce results for their paymasters. So you'll notice everything is always very hurried with them. They say, we've got to stop Kevin Anna. We've got to stop this thing or we're all in danger. That's because they're under a timeline. And if you look at those six characteristics, just check it. Go down that checklist. And when this show gets posted tomorrow, listen again. Go down this checklist and say, that person in your group who's seeming to be kind of, you know, stirring the pot and causing dissension, are they acting like that at all? Or the people they're quoting as the experts on the internet, are they acting like that? Because people just don't act like that. They're following a game plan. And that's, you know, hard experience speaking, all of that.
Wow. You know, as you were talking, I was listening with a bit of fascination because there I was able to take at least three of those examples and directly parallel them to the system, the cult mind, the ritual abuse that I came out of, which is this. If I can just actually take those parallels, you talked about. Talking, they want to talk, and to me that was when I took the stand, and it took about 6 months. I'm going to say this too, for me to recognize what was going on with, you know, in the therapy and in my healing process and my awareness and my waking up of my recovering my memories and everything. It took about 6 months until I realized I have got to cut these guys off. I have to break away. And so when I did that, the reaction that came from that, one of the first things was my dad saying, we need to talk about this. I deserve, and this was his words, I deserve, and I you know, I deserve the right to defend myself, to address what you have, your angers against me or your what you're accusing me of. I don't even know what this is. And so it was a perfect, if I would have gone into that, it was a perfect way for him to, A, get ammunition against me, know what I was, you know, where I was in that moment, and also spin it off into distraction. So that's one parallel. The next parallel was they're afraid of the revolutionaries. Absolutely, they're afraid of that. He was afraid of what I would do because he didn't know what I knew, where I was going to take it. The fear that is mounted against people that are free thinkers, the wild cards, it's untrackable. So if you're doing something that is not, as you were saying, Sun Tzu said, that is not actually predictable, is really where you're getting your upper hand in. And he didn't know exactly how to counter that with me because they're, you know, the disinformation and the lack of information, I was just stating a fact and I was saying, I'm no longer talking to you guys and you're no longer welcome to any family, you know, whatever it was, that was the statement. And I reinforced it with my actions. I didn't have to go into conversation about it and get tired and beat up and even talked around, because that's their scope. They know the rhetoric. They have played out. They've got the rule book, right? I just was like, this is where I'm acting from, mm-hmm. and my actions are going to speak for me at this point. And the other thing that I actually really appreciated was when you said taking back power in our own community, this is your own community of yourself, really. And I'm mm-hmm. such a courage advocate. You know, I would say be kind to yourself, but put down your own game plan. Put down your own agenda and stick to it. When I said goodbye to them, I put down on a 3x5 card what I was going to say. And I didn't have to explain or defend why I was making the choices I was making. I was just saying, this is what I'm doing. And I kept coming back to that. Every time I was challenged, I had that 3x5 card because I was new at this. You know, I was new at saying, I don't want to talk to you anymore. And I was scared and I was afraid and I was shaking. But I also knew more than anything else, my conviction inside was, this is dangerous, this is toxic, and I am not going to engage with this person and these people anymore. So I'm going to stick to my little 3x5 card, my own self-declaration, and I'm going to keep going back to it, and I will not divert from my focus, because that's the one thing I could hold on to, you know, in that phone call and for the next few months, because it takes courage to stick by that too. This is a whole new game plan. Now, I'm years down the road, and if that challenge came to me, if my dad, my mom, my, you know, that family came and said, hey, we're going to challenge you now, I am secure enough and practiced enough where I am in my own beingness, in my own shoes, that I don't need my little 3x5 card to refer to anymore. Right. That's part of who I am. And I think that's what we're trying to encourage people to do, is like, get in the practice, be nice to yourself and have your agenda in you, but know that it's going to be challenged. And know that you're going to be scared and you're going to be shaking and you might not know anything other than what you want the resolve to be, but stick to that. Stick to that.
I remember, this is brilliant, Deb, because, I mean, we're both speaking out of our own life experience. These are not abstract ideas. It's proven in practice, and that's why it's a great teaching, right, for others who may not have gone through this, but will go through this if you stick to your guns. Life teaches us this. I remember my brother almost got drafted and sent to Vietnam. He was a bit too young, but one of his older friends did. And when his friend came back from the war, he said, if you were a raw recruit, you didn't last more than a day because you didn't know what the hell you were doing. And all the veterans hung out together and didn't want to associate with the new recruits because they'd do stupid things. And if you let them lead you, you'd all get killed. The veterans knew how to operate on their own. And that's what a successful battle is, that you organize the seasoned veterans as the leadership cadre. And this is what we're doing. We're not just speaking to everybody. We're ignoring most people, frankly. We're appealing to those people who are able to learn and have been through their own life experience, and they're already veterans in their own way. We find that the best assemblies are formed by those kinds of people who've already been active for many years. They've already learned these lessons. And, there's more to share about that. But that, you know, you're highlighting all of this in a really brilliant way from your own life.
Well, I think, you know, it reflects back to a very strange sentence, but it's a true sentence, which is the privilege is in the struggle. Like, claiming the word veteran doesn't necessarily have to mean I stuck it out and I was a victim of, you know, fill in the blank. But I actually have the privilege of being a part of the process of the sifting. I have the privilege of being part of the exposure to my own morals or my own true compass, my own agenda. I get the privilege of really being put squeezed in the vise or put under the pressure that creates the power really. I mean, you know, you think, you know, the diamond in the rough, you know, what does it start as and what does it turn out from? I mean, it's carbon, right? And then it turns into something that is very valuable. And we can, each of us that's even listening, you can personally, if you take a moment right now, you can personally reflect on something that has happened in your life that you had skin in the game for, man. It took something from you, but you gained something from it. And so this process of shedding and gaining and growing. I mean, even we can get into the idea of a seed. You know, you plant a seed and it's got a casing, and that thing has to, the shoot that you're actually looking forward to has to burst out of that casing, and then it's got to push through a bunch of soil, and then it's got to burst through up to the top, and it's a whole different environment. And you don't even know what it's going to turn into, or it doesn't necessarily know what it is. It just knows it only wants to become what it's meant to be. And that whole discovery can be magical or it can be terrifying, and it's probably both at some point.
It is both. And, you know, the brilliant thing about what we're talking about, this applies to our inner battle and to our outer battles. It's really one and the same. And for people who, you know, we're all emphasized different things in our work. Some of us need to do the inner work more. You have to face the inner demons to be able to do the outer work. But sometimes the outer work helps you face the inner demons. I mean, it goes in both directions. And so that's something we try to do in our assemblies, address these things, but not have it become a therapy session for people. Always related to what we're doing in the world. And, you know, people go far with this. Now, and we've got less than 10 minutes left, about 6 minutes, actually. And I wanted to flag something. We're going to talk about ghost people. And maybe we can flag this for next time. because when I got one of the first Native families I ever spoke to back in the 90s when I started working in Port Alberni, a man called Nelson Keepla, and he said the first word they ever shared when Captain Cook showed up on the West Coast and met with his people, they called them Nootkas, the Nootka people, because that was the word his ancestors were saying to Captain Cook. And the British thought, oh, they're called Nootka. But no, Nootka in Nelson Keeble's language means, what are you doing here? That's what they said to the British when they showed up in their ships. What are you doing here? You people are lost. Who are you? You're like ghosts. And then the name they eventually gave to white people on the coast was Mumukni, which means ghost people. The people without a home, they're drifting around. They don't have substance. And you know what's remarkable about that? We're experiencing it right now. We are living in a culture of ghosts. We're living among people without substance. And why that happened, how it happened, you know, we talked a little bit about that, about a legacy of genocide, how it happened to our own ancestors, you know, our own roots torn up in Europe, forced over here. We've been through a lot of trauma at every level, and a lot of us are reduced to the level of ghosts. And I want to get into that more, you know, because it's affecting what we do now. We often get that sense, not only am I the only one in the store that's not wearing a muzzle, but it feels like they're all dead. Literally, I'm sure a lot of us get that feeling sometimes. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. Actually, it's just interesting how ghost people, it's like there's so many implications of ghosts. I mean, even the idea of being walking dead, and then the thought of when you do die, you give up the ghost, right? It is almost, there's a duality there that is fascinating because you can give up your own deadness, you know, into a life if you choose. But until you choose that, there are so many that are walking dead. And what I think these ghost people, the ones that at least I have walked among and I still walk among, I can, you know, talk to them almost on a daily basis sometimes. I think these are the ones that are overwhelmed by the idea of sovereignty. They confuse this idea of sovereignty with isolation, which is done by design, I'm going to have you say, that the idea of being isolated is terrifying. But it plays on our own fears of being alone. And so the idea of being sovereign somehow is terrifying, because then that means you have responsibility. And elderly people speak to, I want to be responsible. There's this idea that has been really kind of planted in humans that being responsible is impossible. It means you are alone, and you have to be responsible for all of it, and you know, all of that. And then it encourages people to kind of go back into the mass group thought, which is a systemic, it's an idea of systemic belonging versus community, which I see as two different things. Systemic belonging is what we're seeing now, again, with the masking. We kind of went on with that. It's like we're being branded, you know, systemic belonging versus community. Being in a community, humans are communal beings. We love community. We love to connect. We love to connect with our surroundings, our nature, our interests, our creativities, our sciences. We love to connect. That is community. If you can allow that to grow organically, there is something really powerful, beautiful, and lovely about
but
that.
None of us
systemic
have,
belonging
that's the reality,
is
though.
Like where I'm afraid to be alone.
None of us have that experience, though. Can any of us really say we've ever been in that kind of community? We've never experienced, quote, democracy.
No.
We've never experienced what Jesus talks about, right? So it's an abstraction to us, even to the best of us, right? And
yes, so there it is. You
that's
have
part
to be
of the
risky.
Difficulty.
You've got
right.
to take that risk and go
yeah.
into it. Go ahead.
Right. No, we've only got about 3 minutes left, so I just wanted to thank you. Again, this has been a really, really great conversation, and I know it's responding to a lot of the questions and concerns that have come out of our different groups about how do we respond to infiltrators, how do we keep going. I want to just let people know that we're making amazing progress. Like I mentioned in the past, we've had over 2,000 new volunteers across Canada, new assemblies starting everywhere, and the people coming forward now are frankly more mature. They've learned these lessons. They're learning from these experiences, including by listening to the show. So please get this information out. Get people to listen to the show every week. It's how we garner and share our hard-won lessons. And don't forget, people, these lessons are won at the cost of other people's lives. You know, we wouldn't know about genocide unless it was for my friends like Harry Wilson, Billy Coombs, other natives living on the streets who paid with their life to bring out the truth of what we're now experiencing. So we honor them by honoring that ability in ourselves to be equally courageous and to say no and not give up. So I want to encourage people to go over to our sites, republicofcanada.ca, murderbydecree.com, write to us at republicofcanada@gmail.com. We are next week going to be hopefully having some of the people from the East Coast Maritime Assembly talking about what do we do to create these alternative balloting systems for elections. How do we use the election to get the truth out more? How do we use the lessons we've been talking about today in a way that's going to strengthen us against further attacks? Because they will only get worse before things get better. And we've got to be forearmed by being forewarned. And Deb, any final words before we leap to our song?
You know, I would just say, let's be aware of where you are casting your vote with your energy. Be aware of where you put your energy and what you're saying yes to. And if it resonates with you, then really be aware that you're making that conscious choice. So let's be more conscious than unconscious in what we're doing each day.
Absolutely. Thank you, Deb. It's always great, an honor and privilege to have you on the show with me. So thank you. And
thanks, Kevin.
Final thought, people talk about the evil being done to us. Nothing is ever done to us. If they brought in a law tomorrow saying you all had to stay in your house all day, that has no authority over you unless you comply. They have an idea. It comes real and becomes a reality by you complying with it. The power is in your hands to make it real or not. So evil is never done to you. It's done with you. It's done with your compliance and consent. All we have to do now is live by the civil disobedience campaign we started this last month, say no to the COVID measures. You are armed with laws to allow you to do that and hold people liable for trying to force those measures on us. It's now in your hands, people. If the evil happens, it's only because you're complying with it, either by your action or failure to act. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. We're going to end now with a song. I think this is a theme song of our Republic movement. It's Farewell to the Crown. We're talking about Lizzie Britt over there in London. She's on waivers, people. She's nothing. She never was a sovereign. We, the people, are sovereign. Stay strong. Stay clear. We'll be back next week. I thank you.